Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I am a former middle school teacher. I'm a current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. I believe that educators are a critical component in terms of helping students reach their creative potential. And so we explore these ideas on this podcast, and I try to put out about a podcast a week. Today we're going to be talking about this so-called new normal, which, newsflash, is not going to be normal and is not feeling all that new anymore. What does it mean to teach in this upcoming school year? And I want to hone in on one area in particular: what it means to have student collaboration in remote and in hybrid learning. I know a lot of teachers are going to be teaching remotely. My own kids, their school district just announced here in Oregon, the Salem-Keizer School District said, we're going fully remote until at least the end of November. And I know other schools are doing hybrid where, you know, some of the students are working online, some are at home. Some teachers are going to be doing, you know, having a group for 2 days, then having a different group for the next 2 days. So it's going to be tough, right? And I want to talk about what it means to have student collaboration work in those environments. I'm going to be, at some point in the next month or so, putting out a book on this topic of empowering students in distance learning and really getting into this idea of what does that mean in these hybrid environments and in these remote environments. But today I just want to talk about, you know, what does it mean in terms of student collaboration? So we've all been there before when we were students. We had heard those dreaded words, group project, and you immediately begin calculating the additional work that you will need to do in order to keep the group afloat. You check the list of names on the board. You'll be with the drifter who wanders around the class chatting with friends. You'll have the needy student who wants to ask his teacher a ton of questions every single time before you make any decision as a group. Then you'll have the feisty fighter who picks arguments out of sheer boredom. At that point, you realize that you'll be doing four times the work that you would normally do for a project because you're working with a team that's not necessarily buying into it. It's no wonder that so few remote learning classes include collaborative grouping. After all, the challenges of in-person groups seem amplified in virtual spaces. There tends to be less accountability for group members and less oversight from instructors. And it's easier than ever for certain students in a group to just disappear and avoid getting work done. Logistically, it can be challenging to schedule collaborative meetings. And for that reason, it's tempting to just not do collaborative groups at all when it comes to remote. And yet, there is a cost when it comes to distance learning. Distance learning often leads to isolation. During the pandemic, many students described the feelings of loneliness and disconnect as they shifted to these online virtual environments. This disconnect is amplified when online courses are designed with only individual work in mind. We are social creatures. It's who we are. And over two decades ago, researchers Anderson and Garrison have demonstrated that success in an online course depended on the relationship that students had between the content, the instructor, and classmates. Furthermore, when students are not collaborating with classmates, they miss out on new perspectives and new ideas and new approaches to solve problems. They miss out on the opportunity to develop critical soft skills like communication and problem solving and creative thinking. In other words, it's really important that they have opportunities to collaborate. In remote learning, students often interact with one another without actually engaging in collaborative work. Here they're cooperating rather than collaborating. So they interact with other students, but they never actually have that place of mutual trust and collaboration and dependency on each other. And that can be a real problem. If you're interested in this distinction between cooperation and collaboration, I just want to say you can check it out on YouTube. Type in cooperation versus collaboration, and the sketch video that I have will come up. And I'm just going to point this out right now. I would love for you to subscribe to my YouTube channel. I make lots of these sketch videos. I love doing that. I have one that I just recently created about the difference between synchronous and asynchronous learning. It's something you can use with students. Something you can use with fellow staff members. So I'm just going to put in that plug right now. If you want to know more about it, the sketch video that I made is about 2 minutes long, and it's a great way to make sense out of it. The key, though, if we're thinking about this, true collaboration, is to craft the learning experience so that we can make the most out of collaborative grouping. Now, this is admittedly challenging. However, we can help students become better self-starters and self-managers in their small groups when we design structures to increase student ownership in the collaborative process. And this actually starts at the individual level. We have to ensure individual accountability. Even though group members are working together as a whole, each individual member should be contributing. If students are working on a group project, they should move between individual partner and small group tasks. In other words, they shouldn't just be working together as a group during every single part of the process. This has the added bonus of allowing introverts additional processing time, while also ensuring that each member is mutually accountable for their own work. One of the ways to do this is to start from a place of interdependent learning. Now, if independent learning is fully autonomous and dependent learning involves students simply depending on another person, like the teacher or their group members, interdependence is this overlap where students have autonomy, but they also have to depend on each other at the same time. When students work interdependently, each member is adding value to the group project. Each member has something of value that they are actually contributing. So what does this actually look like? Well, one example is in brainstorming. Here, each group member generates ideas alone and then meets together as a group to share their ideas, to narrow down their ideas, and to clarify their ideas. So notice that when this is happening, it's fully interdependent. Students must listen to each other and depend on each other for new ideas. At the same time, they must also contribute. Even the so-called low student has something of value to add to the group. And this is the core idea of interdependence. Each member has something of value to contribute. A distance learning variation of this activity is to have students submit their ideas on a shared Google form and then analyze the spreadsheet afterwards. They can negotiate their ideas with a video chat or asynchronously on a shared document. Similarly, when doing research, each student can add additional information to the group's shared knowledge. They can read articles or listen to podcasts. They can be at various reading levels. They can have different interest levels. But then as a group, they all share their ideas as they debrief in a video conference or as they add things to a shared graphic organizer. And yet, I also want to point out that interdependent structures alone will not guarantee that individual students engage in collaborative work. Teams will often have to navigate conflict to deal with students who disengage. And it's important to remember that disengagement is really, really complicated. Some students check out because the task seems too hard or seems too confusing. Others struggle to get along with their teammates. Some of them are just lost and confused. Some of them are saying this is too hard. Some of them are just having bad days. Some of them are dealing with trauma. You get the idea. It is complicated. And for this reason, it also helps to have team members develop a set of shared norms or expectations. So the second big idea is to have them empower teams to set norms and expectations. While it's important to have norms for your entire classroom community, it's also important to have students in small groups develop their norms as a team. As a teacher, you might suggest some categories. You might say, you know, I want you to come up with some for being responsible, communication, active participation, conflict resolution, respect. other times you might just have the students develop the norms on their own. You might even ask them to look at sample norms. And then once groups have created that initial brainstorm of norms, I think it works really well to place students in other groups to see if there are norms from other groups that they might want to bring back to their groups. Next, have the groups expand their norms and then narrow down their norms. And then finally, they can wordsmith the norms in the end. The goal should be consensus rather than voting. In other words, the entire group should unanimously agree upon what the norms are. And I think that's really important. This is why, by the way, I love having collaborative teams work together for, you know, 3 or 4 weeks rather than simply for a day or two. You really want to give some time to develop these norms and expectations. It's important that students understand that the norms are their shared expectations, that it's not something imposed upon them. It's something that they are developing on their own. And after students have developed their norms, they need to have a process for providing feedback to one another. Some teachers provide group contracts where each team has norms and consequences. Other teachers use mediation techniques to help students who are struggling with each other. Some teachers might do an anonymous survey. It's really up to you. But the goal is to develop trust and to have them give feedback to one another. I want to point something out here, though. I really believe that students should never grade one another. Giving feedback is one thing. It helps us improve, but it can really backfire when you have team members give each other a group grade. This can create risk aversion where team members are afraid to speak up. It can also introduce an unhealthy power dynamic, and students aren't trained in formal assessment theory or practice. And you as the instructor should be the sole person grading group members. At the same time, I think it's important that you do give each group member a different grade. Third big idea is to empower teams to own the project management process. Teams often struggle with self-management. So even if they have norms, even if there's interdependence, they don't have an easy time self-managing. They're going to miss deadlines, they're going to fail to use time effectively, and this is often amplified in groups where members are good friends. So even when they have interdependent structures and they have group norms, the entire small group can become really unproductive really fast. And this is especially true in virtual environments where the instructor isn't constantly present to keep members on task. The counterintuitive solution is actually to let students own the project management process. As students own more of the process, they develop the skills related to collaborative self-management. Here's what I mean. Project management begins with goal setting based on the big picture idea of what you want to accomplish. Here, students need to have a clear sense of where they are going and what it will look like when they are finished. As a teacher, you can help walk them through this visualization process by modeling the thinking process as a class. You might provide sentence frames or even exemplars the first time that they're doing this to help them think strategically about their goals. You might even hold a virtual meeting where you provide feedback on their goals as they first meet in a small group, which leads to the next part. Project management also involves breaking down the project into tasks and subtasks with clear, strong deadlines. As a teacher, you can empower groups to set the deadlines on their own. You might provide a graphic organizer that helps them visualize each part of a task, creating a bridge between the abstract ideas and concrete actions. And in this phase, teams develop a plan of action and select the tools and materials that they're going to be using. If you're working collaboratively, you often divide up roles and responsibilities. Students can negotiate who will do what in terms of tasks and ownership. This can help ensure that groups are valuing individual student agency while also working as a cohesive team. And as a teacher, you might create group roles as an initial framework and then allow team members to modify those roles as they see fit. Notice that students will choose the specific strategies. Here, student ownership includes their method of tracking progress. And I think this part is key. Some students are going to use something like a color-coded spreadsheet that they share. I have an example on this blog. And by the way, I have a sketch video on project management you might want to check out too. But we have task, subtask, member responsible, deadline, and progress. Another option, though, is that you might want to use something like a Trello board. Now, this is great if you teach secondary levels, not as good if you teach younger students. But this allows them to use progress bars, to-do lists, and virtual cards. I love using Trello. It's one of my favorite options. Students will likely run into barriers, which will force them to problem solve and experiment, which is another part of being a self-manager. They might even need to pivot and re-examine some of their goals. But this is a chance for you as a teacher to walk them through this iterative process. The next idea is to empower students to own the communication process. Sometimes students struggle with collaboration in learning because of the challenges in virtual communication. For this reason, it really helps to teach students when to use synchronous and asynchronous communication tools. In other words, you can empower groups to set up the type of communication along with setting their schedules. I'm going to share the distinction between synchronous and asynchronous real quickly here. Synchronous communication happens in real time in the moment. Asynchronous communication does not happen in real time. Instead, it can happen over a longer period of time. Both synchronous and asynchronous communication have their distinct advantages and disadvantages. Synchronous communication is faster. It's also way more dynamic. It's great for active participation, for iterative discussions, for interaction between group members. It tends to work well in small groups, but it can lead to frequent interruptions and distractions. And so if a group member is constantly using this and they're interrupting each other, then they actually don't get as much work done. But with asynchronous communication, there's no need to schedule, which means you can go at your own pace with fewer disruptions. Asynchronous communication works really well when the internet is unstable and you're gonna deal with students who have unstable, unpredictable Wi-Fi. Or when participants are in different time zones, it's not as much of an issue. Or when they have schedules, right? So students might be, having to share a computer at their home and they have to work around different schedules and they might be babysitting siblings, and so it really allows for students to schedule, kind of take an, anytime, anywhere approach to their work. Asynchronous communication also tends to allow for a permanent record of the communication, and that is really helpful for you as a teacher because you can check in at any time and look back at that record. However, asynchronous communication doesn't work well when you need to address issues in the moment, and it can feel less interactive. So again, asynchronous is great for, an anytime, anywhere approach. It's great for things that are unstable. It's more convenient. But, group members are going to need to interact in the moment. And so it's going to be really important that they have access to those tools. Some communication platforms blend synchronous and asynchronous, right? A walkie-talkie app lets you communicate in the moment, but also listen later and even adjust the speed. A shared document has real-time edits, but the comments are asynchronous and there's a permanent record of all the annotations. You can do video chats in real time, but record them for replay later. And this can really help with accessibility. Meanwhile, social media platforms often blend together live and recorded videos, chats, and updates. So it's really common to have this overlap between those two. Often collaborative teams will blend together synchronous and asynchronous tools as they engage in remote learning. And in some cases, you might have to navigate the terrain with them. And this is why it's really important to do small group check-ins. And that's my final thought here. Empower your teams, but still do check-ins. Distance learning doesn't have to be relationally distant. In fact, it should not be relationally distant. And what do I mean? As teachers, we need to be intentional about creating a presence with our students. Here's a few different ideas. One is you can do video announcements. It could be pre-recorded, it could be live. You can do small group check-ins. Here you schedule a video meeting, video conferencing with them. You can do email checkups. I love this because you can just send an email to each group member and ask them how they're doing. You can do short text check-ins. With this option, you can ask students to use the chat function to send questions or comments as you go. And you just do really quick text-based, you know, short chat check-ins. Surveys are another option. Ask students to fill out a survey each day about what their experience has been, how they're collaborating as a group. You get the idea. Or you could schedule conferences. And I've written before about the five-minute conference system. But I think doing a group conference and using the five-minute conference system as a group can be helpful as well. It's not always easy to make collaboration work in remote learning. We know that. It is rarely easy. That's part of why so few instructors design the systems to make this happen. Even when you design those systems well, there's going to be challenges and conflicts because humans are inherently messy and students are deeply human. But there's also something powerful that happens when the collaboration works. And the fact that it's challenging shouldn't discourage us from designing the systems that will boost that creative collaboration. Ultimately, it will be an experiment, and some things won't work, and that is absolutely okay. But when they do work, your students will be developing skills that will last for a lifetime. Someday they will be working on teams, and they will probably work remotely. And so you can help them develop those skills right now in the here and now and empower them to own the process as they work in collaborative teams. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcast? Again, thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.